How far would you be willing to travel to eat some oysters? Well, let's book a ticket on the Transcontinental Railroad to find out this week on Seemingly Unrelated. Welcome back to Seemingly Unrelated, the podcast where we connect the seemingly mundane elements of everyday life to the most unbelievable but true stories across history, stories across society, stories from culture, all around time and space. I'm your host, Dr. Andrew Johnstone, lecturer in media, culture, and society. I think I finally nailed it at the University of Glasgow. And as always, this time I remembered to introduce our producer, engineer, editor, and younger person than me. It's Naomi. Hey, Naomi.
Hello. I was forgotten to be introduced last time, and Andrew's never going to make that mistake again. I was very stern about it.
It's going to haunt me in my dreams. And this episode, we've got another great guest co-host. And this time, we've pulled someone who already has a studio set up in his home because he is a podcaster, marketing consultant, and a really big lover, I would say, of all things media. It is, from a lot of different podcasts he's about to tell you about, Kobe Omanaka. Hey, Kobe. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's a pleasure to be here, guys. It's a pleasure to meet the younger generation of Manchester in Naomi and a kindred older spirit who's now north of the Great Wall of, I can't remember what that wall's called.
Adrian's Wall
that divides us, England and Scotland. It's great to be here. I'm a big fan of the podcast, so it's great looking behind the curtain and seeing when you look behind the curtain that it's still fantastic as well. So it's not like a Wizard of Oz situation, guys.
All of this flattery is very much necessary. So, Kobe, as I alluded to, you're a podcaster, but why don't you give a chance for the audience to get to know you a little bit more? Just tell them a bit about what you do. Who are you?
Digital marketer is my 90% of what I do work-wise. And before I was a digital marketer, I worked in oil and gas as a chemical engineer. And the reason I say this is because my transition from chemical engineering to digital marketing happened because of podcasting. So podcasting, even though it doesn't really drive my revenue, is such a huge part of my life and I owe a lot to it. And it's amazing fun. And you meet amazing people like Andrew, who I've known for, come on, 8 years now at least.
At least, I think 8-9 years, somewhere in that range. Yeah.
And so Andrew's been on a few podcasts I host and produce. One of the biggest ones is one about The Wire called The Wire Stripped. Andrew's from the great city of Baltimore where The Wire is set. And whenever his voice appears on the show, all our fans go, "This is the guy! This is the guy we need!" And I'm like, yeah, Andrew's the best. and he's joined us on, my friend, my co-host Helen, have a podcast called Flix Watcher, which is all about films that are on Netflix at the time. And Andrew's joined us a couple of times. Brought in some good films, brought in some not so good films.
Oh, I don't think I have not brought any good films to the table. The two films I brought were The Neverending Story and Ariana Grande's, I forget the name. Yeah. Thank you, I love you. I can't remember what it's called.
Ariana Grande, Forgettable Title.
I mean, I enjoyed the Ariana Grande concert.
The Neverending Story is like, I think probably one of the best songs ever in a film. The Neverending Story.
Have you?
Undeniable.
How did you come to know this song, Naomi? I've got one reason why, but I want to see if that's confirmed.
No, I actually had it on tape as a child, the film.
Hold on.
So I used to
Andrew
watch
alluded
the film.
To you being very young, but you know what tape is.
Why did you have The Neverending Story? Yeah, you know what tape
is. I was born in 1998, so I'm like 1 year into Gen Z.
I went to university.
You see, and I was watching The Neverending Story on tape. Yeah, how did you think I knew the Neverending Story?
Stranger Things.
No, I was there on tape.
Yes, Flix Watcher, we were on. You guys could check that out. I enjoy watching Ariana Grande do a pretty good concert, and then for some reason that being considered a documentary. I enjoyed it. Everyone else did not.
Well, we've folks who are listening now, we've invited Naomi to join us on Flix Watcher, so hopefully you can hear her tones in a future episode.
You can't pick the Neverending Story because it's already been done. Sorry.
Oh, don't worry. I have many more amazing films lined up.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So,
let's get cracking with today's episode. And this will be an interesting... I'm excited to hear the answer to this, Kobe. I've got a very important question. Do you like, from a perspective of eating, consuming, oysters? What's your vibe when it comes to eating oysters?
Oysters are, I will eat them if they're presented to me. Sometimes just someone says, here's an oyster. I'm like, okay, well, I'll try that. But I will rarely seek them out.
I would like to hang out with whoever the people are you're hanging out with that just offer you oysters.
I say that as if it's a weekly occurrence. This is like...
It's every Thursday. Yeah. It's Oyster Thursday. I just go to my buddy's house and oysters appear. Oddly enough, oysters, despite the fact that they have this reputation of being something served at the Ritz, traditionally are a working man's meal.
Right.
So they're just oysters, for anyone who's not familiar. They are just saltwater bivalve mollusks, which means they just like have a little shell that opens and has one sort of joint on the back. And they are filter feeders, meaning anything in the water flows through them.
Yep.
And then they take the little bits they want out of it to consume and spit the water back out, which is good for the water. Right. And it makes for a much healthier, cleaner, safer ecosystem. But it means that what gets into the oyster is whatever was in the water before it made its way to the oysters. And they're also known as being very nutritious. Apparently, they're rich in vitamin B12 and zinc. Cool. Fun fact about oysters. So they are, in fact, the very first fast food of the United States. Oyster consumption was at its peak between the 1840s and 1900. And in the same way that today, if you're in any place in the United States, you'll see, you know, a McDonald's across the street from a Burger King, down the road from a Wendy's, and then like the whatever the regional burger place is. In that same time period, you would have seen oyster bars, oyster saloons, oyster inns, oyster counters, just like literally just a piece of wood and somebody is handing oysters out. And something called...
Sorry, you don't even see the heads. You don't even see the heads. You just see the hands with the oysters.
Correct. It's just oysters pop up. You go, you put your money down, you take some oysters, you go. And something called an oyster cellar, which is literally a basement where you can buy oysters and a drink.
I hate this just town. Sounds creepy. I think this sounds like my worst nightmare. They're just like snot, no? They're just like big snot things.
Or oysters.
Yeah. They've got
same consistency.
They were absolutely everywhere. Like, and you say you hate this town. Do not time travel to the back half of the 19th century in the United States, Naomi, because this is every town in the United States. On average, in 1890, Americans ate 600 oysters per year per person, which is just about an average of 2 oysters a day. So if you're from Massachusetts, the Plymouth Rock area, that Cape Cod Bay, lots of oysters. Same thing on the West Coast, right? We're on the Puget Sound, plenty of oysters. But what's really fascinating is that when you dig into this oyster craze, as it's known, there are people writing about eating oysters in their diaries in Missouri, Wisconsin, Colorado, and New Mexico.
Like, so for people outside of the U.S., that's inland, not coastal in any way, shape, or form.
Super inland. Missouri, for anyone who doesn't know, is the exact center of the United States, of the lower 48, leave Alaska and Hawaii out of this. So it's the dead center. There is nowhere for oysters to be. And yet people are writing oyster recipes in their the little church recipe books that used to be so popular in the United States.
So I'm guessing back then, I can't remember when the Wright brothers existed, but I'm guessing there was no planes then, or even like automated vehicles. So transport of oysters would have taken a minute.
Correct. It would have taken you quite a while. So the typical trip from Washington, D.C. to San Francisco, California in 1840 was 6 months. We don't have any airplanes for at least a decade till after this sort of period.
Yeah.
And why are people eating so many oysters? What's your guess on that one, Kobe?
I would have guessed because they're cheap and available. Just get them out, pull them out yourself in the sea.
They are definitely cheap. Oysters at that time were half the price of beef by weight.
Yeah.
So very, very inexpensive. And they have the same protein content as beef. So for people who are trying to get enough protein in their diet, you're pretty much one-to-one for half the price. But that'll also have, as we said, loads of zinc, which, according to The Simpsons, it makes telephones work and the firing pin on a handgun. Zinc reference there. Also, when we think of oysters, Kobe, what does an oyster do to a person? Not only are they delicious, but they've got a reputation to them.
Their reputation is a sexy food, like a pre-Viagra.
Yeah. Male enhancement.
Yeah, but I think it applied to all genders as an aphrodisiac. But I believe, that was the main. I think that was the main kind of thrust. The main reason that people advocated for oysters.
That is definitely when we get to the 1980s and things like that. That was the big. It actually kind of starts in the 60s, that run.
Yeah.
But that was sort of the selling point, because as Naomi has pointed out, it's not for everyone. Like a raw oyster in particular can carry, it's going to be salty depending on the water it was in. It tastes like the ocean, right? Mm. Like it's like when you go to the beach and you smell the ocean. That's what you're eating. And so it kind of depends on the water it comes from. But the big selling point was, it is good for sexy times. And there's been a lot of theories as to who put two and two together the first time. Some people recommend that vitamin B12 does sort of enhance blood flow, and it sort of gives people energy and vigor. Other people note that you harvest them, like oysters, mostly in warmer months. So the people who are eating them are probably wearing less clothing than usual, which I think is pretty specious. But I like the idea that because oysters, again, are not for everyone, they have become associated always with clear, stringent liquors like gin or grain whiskey. You pair shots, right? You pour a little like vodka into your oyster, which the mucous membrane
I'm so grossed out.
That actually goes around the oyster. You cannot dissolve it in water, but it does fall apart in alcohol. So when you pour a little vodka on it, it becomes less slimy, but then you have liquor. So you're just eating, if you eat a dozen oysters, you're probably taking like a dozen shots of vodka at the same time.
I thought they were just drinking shots because it was so disgusting that they couldn't get through it. And I thought, why is anyone subjecting themselves to this? But that makes a bit more sense.
Eat some oysters, drink some liquor, go home with somebody for the evening and enjoy yourselves. So you already noted, we don't have air travel. We don't have, there's not the trucking industry. In fact, the automobile is an invention of the 1890s when a guy named Diesel invented an engine that we now call the diesel engine. Good for him. So how did these things get around all of the United States. How was it possible that someone in New Mexico could get their hands on oysters? And I got a question that's going to answer that for you, Kobe. Please, if you wouldn't mind, could you fill in our international listeners on the current state of rail travel in the United Kingdom?
I mean, generally, the train is fine, apart from the fact it's very expensive if you want to go some distances.
I'm so shocked you say this about English trains.
Yeah.
Because I think pretty much every train I got from London to Manchester has been cancelled or delayed. And I was on one the other day. I was literally on it and it got cancelled whilst I was on it.
Oh,
and
wow.
I was like, I'm already on the train.
I have had that when you're on it. And ladies and gentlemen, we're just waiting for the driver to turn up because he couldn't be asked to get out of bed right now. But he'll be here soon.
Yeah.
Ding dong. Yeah, we found out he actually could not be asked. So
so
it's time to
you
go
will
on to a different train. Yeah.
And now for something completely unrelated. Yeah, and I remember like when I got back from Japan where it was just all so organized, the trains. Yeah. Nothing will ever go wrong and everything's really clean. And then I got back to London and I'd been struggling with how structured Japan was because I'm not a very structured person. And Euston, every single train was cancelled, including mine. Waited for half an hour. Everyone was shouting. There was pigeons flying at my head because there's just always pigeons in the train station. And then suddenly the number got called and where to board. And about 100 people all ran with all of their stuff. And as we're running, we get to the train and there's no aircon on the train. It smells like feet. And then we sit on it for another half an hour before we leave. And I thought, I'm so happy to be home.
Give me that chaos. So it is rail connections that make possible this emergence of oyster as a fast food. So the first fast, just like fast food as we understand it, the McDonald's style fast food is facilitated by the car, the personal automobile, people be able to drive to get it. The first fast food is facilitated by the existence of rail networks. So the 1840s is when the United States really starts to develop a rail network. The rail starts to establish in the 1840s. The Transcontinental Railroad, however, which connected Washington, D.C. to San Francisco via rail, did not finish until about 1870. So there is a 30-year period where this thing is developing. But as it sort of spreads, it becomes these little, like, almost like spider webs. If you look at the maps over the years from about 1840 to 1870, it just seems like every couple of miles on track, you'll just see these spurs that go off and become these, like, these little mini networks all across the United States with big, I picked some exotic locales that became unexpected hubs. Some would might say seemingly unrelated hubs. Altoona, Pennsylvania, Texarkana, Texas, Albuquerque, New Mexico, and of course, where the swallows go every year, San Juan Capistrano, California. All of them becoming weird regional hubs across the United States. So the Transcontinental Railroad was funded by the government. So the federal government of the United States passed the Pacific Railroad Act of 1862. Now, I got two Brits, and I know I asked two other British people a history question a couple episodes ago, and it went awesome. So let's see how it goes this time. 1862 in the United States, Kobe. Any idea what major, one of the most major events in U.S. history might be going on in 1862 in the United States?
So I am a Hamilton fan.
Okay.
So this is post-Civil War, right, though, isn't it?
It is not post-Civil War, no.
Okay, so it's during Civil War then.
It is during
okay.
the Civil War. That is correct. April 1861 is the beginning of the U.S. specifically Civil War.
Sure.
And it was indeed signed into law by Lincoln. Noted railroad corporate lawyer turned president Abraham Lincoln.
Are you surprised that pull there?
No, I mean, I guess I should be. I to me, it's so funny because to me, it's so obvious. So last time when poor Ree and Naomi were like, I don't know how World War II ended. I was like,
he literally asked us how World War II ended, which I feel like is pretty much all we learned about in school was World War II. So the fact that neither of us had an answer for it was quite worrying. We won't even go into it because it was a whole thing. And it was very stressful for me, and it made me question all of my general knowledge of history.
So you're right. I should take a second to recognize, because especially since it's not your country's history, to know that the 1860s is either the immediate post-Civil War era or the Civil War era is a kudos. So you get it. Ready? Golf clap. See if you can hear.
I've been watching a lot of golf TV shows recently. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Good. So, signed into law, Abraham Lincoln helping pay his old buddies in the railroads, agreed to the government would pay private companies to build, because the United States, build the railroad at the cost of $16,000 per mile of track construction.
Is this adjusted for inflation?
Nope. That is the $1862 dollar amount. Today, it would be $562,000 per mile.
Whoa.
So about $500,000 a mile is what the federal government was willing to compensate these corporations to build railroads between Council Bluffs, Iowa, which was the end of these rail connections that came from the east, all the way to Oakland, California, which would then connect up to the rail connections, which were built on the West Coast. And that does bring us back, of course, if anyone wants to go back and listen to the Spelling Bee episode and the Chinese Exclusion Act, you know all about how bad the construction of that railroad went. It gets real racist real fast.
I thought we were going to go down the, I do remember that episode. I remember, but I was also thinking the, go down the slave and prison routes for building these rail routes. Happening.
So that is an interesting thing about the construction of the railroads. Now, this is not to say there were no enslaved people constructing the railroad at any point in U.S. history. That would be inaccurate. But it's not a very popular choice. Part of that has to do with the fact that most enslaved persons were dedicated to agriculture. And the other part of it is straight up unions. Like, unions started to form.
Sure.
And they were the people working in, because rail construction required some skills. You know, you have to be engineers, know how things work. So there was not a ton of slaves used at that time. Now, former enslaved people employed at a very, very low cost after the Civil War. Oh yes, oh yes, that's how they from Council Bluffs headed west. That's who they deployed, and then from Oakland headed east, they employed Chinese people. So, what does this have to do with oysters? It's going to be the next question. But before we jump into that, we've got a new segment this week that we want to try out for you. It's called What's Your Deep Dive? Cue the music.
What is your deep dive?
There we go. I want to take a step back and ask you, Kobe. Obviously, every episode, I dive into something that really speaks to me. We found out a couple episodes ago that Naomi really likes the research hamsters. So, guest spotlight, what's a subject that you love to do a deep dive on? Could you just, in a couple minutes, to take our listeners, where are your Wikipedia rabbit holes? What are your YouTube obsessions? Where do you spend all your time?
A weird confession.
I'm so intrigued.
So yeah, like my YouTube is like serving me up these pimple popping videos, and I can't not watch them.
I love them. They are amazing. I don't know. It's kind of grosses me out and completely satisfies my urge to pop pimples all in the same video.
This is where we part ways, Naomi. Thank you for your service.
It was nice working for you.
Yeah.
And one YouTube search was, or one ChatGPT search was like, hold on. When I was a teenager, we were told never to burst these spots. But now I'm seeing these dermatologists bursting these spots. What's going on here? And Chatsworth GPT was like, yeah, that's right. Don't do it at home because you are a dirty, dirty individual and you'll probably make yourself infected.
So we've got the government paying for this transcontinental railroad, but what does that have to do with oysters? And that means we've got to go deeper into our history and ask, what about the railroads that came before 1862? This 20-year period between when they start to be built and the federal government has nothing to do with them, and then when the federal government finally seizes the opportunity to build things. And that means I'm going to pull again on your expertise here, Co, because you already alluded to it at the beginning that with Stripped Media, you've been doing a podcast for years now. That means you probably know exactly what city in the United States was the first site of a rail connection.
Well, I'm guessing it's Baltimore then.
That's right. Baltimore is the home, the originator of the rail networks in the United States, with the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad being constructed in 1828. So actually, even by UK standards, that's pretty young, where, you know, rail was invented here in the UK. But it's not until the 18-teens that we start to get the connections, with the first intercity connection, I believe, being like London to, it's somewhere silly. It's like London to Woking or something. Like, it's like this really tiny trip where you're like, oh, I guess those are two different cities. but then eventually with Birmingham and Manchester being connected to London. But the initial point of these rail connections were to get goods from outside of Baltimore in to Baltimore, because the harbor is huge. Like the volume of shipping that was going out of Baltimore in that time was enormous. It was the second largest port on the East Coast after New York City. Mm-hmm. A title it would maintain until, I think, the 1950s or something like that. And so it was all about bringing the goods from the rest of Maryland, Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, to Baltimore, then putting them on boats and shipping them off to wherever they were going to go. And what was a huge product, a thing that was so substantial that if you go to the Inner Harbor today in the city of Baltimore, you still see a massive sign, even though it's got a crab on it, a massive sign for the Phillips Seafood Company. In any of your research, have you encountered the Phillips Seafood Company?
No, I know crab's a big thing in Baltimore. And what's that trout called?
Lake trout. Even though there's no lake, and it's definitely not trout, it's called lake trout. Ooh, gross. / delicious. It's just, listen, this is the funny thing. People talk about lake trout like it's crazy. Like, oh, lake trout. It's just fish and chips. So, Phillips seafood in general, is the lifeblood of Maryland. The Chesapeake Bay is the largest estuary in the United States. It is the big body of water just to the east of Baltimore. And the Chesapeake Bay, funny enough, until 1925, was the largest source of oysters in the United States. So many oysters, in fact, that when the first Europeans arrived to settle Maryland, they kept crashing their ships into oyster reefs. they couldn't see them, and then they would just smash into this oyster reef and be like, well, I guess we're building a town here. At its peak, which is about 1880-something, the Chesapeake Bay produced 15 million bushels, which is roughly 1.5 billion oysters a year.
Whoa.
Yes, according to the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science, 1.5 billion oysters per year were shipping out of Baltimore, which is so many oysters. Which, again, if people are eating 600 a year, population of the United States is roughly 120 million people. Yeah, okay. These numbers start to pretty much match up.
Makes sense.
That is really the whole, I mean, obviously things are getting shipped to other places as well, but that was pretty much the whole of the consumption. That's actually the reason the B&O exists. The B&O was literally, let's go out to the oyster farms, because they're not all in Baltimore. So like you'd have to come to the Eastern Shore, which is on the other side of the Chesapeake Bay, where I'm from. Tons of oyster beds there. You'd have to, at that time, go like up and around the top of it to connect up. That takes a long time. But you could do that much faster with a rail network. So they just start building rail connections. And it happens to go hand in hand in the 1830s with the development of a little thing called the tin can. Obviously invented, as we all know, for Napoleon Bonaparte.
I didn't know. Did Napoleon invented the tin can? Seriously?
He did not invent it.
Okay.
He demanded someone find a way to package meat so that it would be more shelf stable, and he paid a lot of money, okay, and someone invented the tin can, and they did it just in time for him to lose his battle in Moscow against the Russians, which is kind of the beginning of the end of his reign. But yeah, the tin can's whole thing was just shelf stability. So an oyster, if you leave an oyster out on the table, gross, first of all. if it's out of the water, it'll last like a day. You could probably, you know, I would say after a couple of hours, maybe don't eat that oyster. But if you put it in a tin can, and maybe you pack that tin can in some ice, those oysters would last back in the 1840s for 5 weeks easily.
Okay.
One could travel some distance with that product. So, as we said before, journey from DC to San Francisco, right, took 6 months.
Yep.
After the construction of the railroad, it was 2 weeks. So those are the, that's just as a reference. That's the kind of timeline shrinkage we're seeing here.
Sure.
Huge. So if it had taken you a couple weeks before, now we're talking about a day.
Yeah.
Right. And so the oyster business explodes at this time period. And it moves into what we call the Wild West. Now, when I say the Wild West, what do you imagine, Kobe?
I think, what's the name of that HBO show? Deadwood.
Ah, Deadwood. Yeah, sure.
So I think any kind of in-depth knowledge of, again, this was a deep dive, would have done like 10 years ago, was when I was watching Deadwood. And I, at some point, realized this was based on actual people. And then started digging down to them. So, because the name Al Swearengen, I was like, that's not a name. And it turns out it was actually a real person.
Yeah.
Al Swearengen, which is
real people.
Great.
And we know a lot about those real people, don't we? Like, they're shockingly well developed, right? And we tend to think of the Wild West in terms of Deadwood or in terms of even Back to the Future as being like way out west, like, you know, New Mexico or California or something like that. Mm. But in reality, it starts way earlier than that. From 1843 to 1890 is really the Wild West period. And it's Wild West places like Kentucky or Indiana, or what's another really boring option? Missouri, like really,
so
the
again,
Midwest.
For your non-US listeners, these are places which are just kind of west of the East Coast, essentially.
Exactly, yeah. Kentucky, I mean, it's not west. You would not consider it in the grand scale of things the west. But the reason people actually move out west, like, and why we have in our minds this Deadwood style, these little towns where everyone's rough and tumble and they seem to be barely scraping by, is because by 1840, there was no land to purchase in what were the established states. Mm. So not the territories, but the established states. Because in the South, all of the land had been concentrated into plantations, which we're going back to. That's where all of the enslaved persons were. They were being forced to work on those plantations. And in the North, huge, huge tracts of land, and actually all the land that was like usable had been bought up by mills and factories. And so we end up with no one can buy land. So they can't like try to make a living as like a farmer. And the factory wages are severely deflated because of industrialization. As productivity increased and more machines were integrated into the system, it was the factory owners just kept paying people less and less and less. So all the people who end up going west are the poorest people. Who are the most desperate. And a lot of them may be the victims of persecution because they were native peoples or they were black or they were Mormons or whatever. So that, quote, Wild West, we call it the Wild West because it's just where the poor people went. And so all the rich people were like, ooh, ew, the Wild West. But all of those people would have come from pretty much East Coast towns.
Yeah.
And they remembered in their East Coast town because they were poor and because oysters cost half as much as beef living on oysters. Oysters were for them a staple in their diet. So what's really interesting to note is that as people move west, the oysters come with them, right?
Yeah.
So everywhere that gets settled, every major city, and it's things like Washington, Denver, Colorado, all these major cities, they all get established and have their first oyster restaurant at least a year before anyone builds a train station.
Oh.
So these people are going west by wagon, or they're going west by horse, they're going west by foot. They're setting up shop. They're opening an oyster restaurant. And then the demand for oysters is so high that legitimately a train station follows. It is a bizarre story. The seemingly unrelated is that the reason why towns that were major rail connections, the reason why the railroad was built from the East Coast to the West, with the exception, of course, of the one line that was paid for by the federal government that was like a straight shot across, was to satisfy people's demand for oysters.
Wow.
Yeah. Everywhere people went, the oyster restaurants followed, and everywhere oyster restaurants went, train stations followed.
I love that that's a thing. something that's so important, so fundamental to people's lives. I can understand that that's what drives and propagates development. It's bizarre that it's oysters in this day and age. Mm-hmm. that's the thing. Something that was so basic that it was a staple to millions of people, but now is seen as a luxury.
Yeah, absolutely. No one's building a rail station today.
Yeah.
To get oysters, right? Like that's just that would be some sort of maniac billionaire behavior. Like, you know, like if
I'm telling you, oysters.
Yeah, I gotta get my oysters.
If anything, I want the train so I can get away from the oysters. I want to go in the other direction to the oysters.
Run away from the oysters. But all the cities I just named, by the way, today, those are all airport hubs.
Oh, okay.
But Dallas, Texas, the Transcontinental Railroad that goes through there wasn't supposed to go through Dallas. It was supposed to go through Houston and Austin, which were the established towns at the time. Mm. And it was because rich people in Dallas wanted to get oysters and a couple other things, but oysters primarily. They wanted that to come through to their town. They bribed government officials to change the rail line a couple of miles north so that it would come through Dallas/Fort Worth.
Just that couple of miles makes all the difference when you want your oyster.
Exactly. Well, you don't want to, well, I don't want to drive to Houston to get my oysters. bring that shit to me now.
So what you're saying then, okay, so oysters propagated the railroads. But then when flight did happen, you know, we talk about Kitty Hawks and people are like, hold on, we can get this even quicker. We've got places ready.
So what happens is, because all this is happening in the buildup to like the 1870s and the 1880s, really by the 1880s, this phenomenon is over. The rail networks are fairly well established in the United States by about 1880 is a good number. Anything after that is sort of like spurs and like maybe connecting a particular mine up, or we're improving access, that sort of thing. But by about 1880, the whole network is put together. So I'm saying that all of the major cities of the United States are only major cities because the demand for oysters was so high that we had to build train stations and train connections there. And since they had those connections and they had those stations, they became rail hubs.
Yeah.
And everywhere there was a rail hub in the United States later would get an airport that would become a significant airport. Not because it's the best place. Denver is not a good place to put an airport. It's high up, so like, you know, it's a mile in the air, so in theory it's easier for planes to land, I guess. But like, where do you go from Denver? Like, you're just in the middle of the Rocky Mountains, but so many people lived in Denver because of the oysters. Because that's the thing. The oysters bring the train, and then the train brings more people, which brings more oysters, and then like it becomes this positive
self-propagating like circle. Yeah.
Yeah. But essentially, if we want to put this in the modern context, this would be like if you went to a town and you wanted McDonald's so bad that you would build an airport just so that McDonald's could like open a shop in that airport so that you could get your McDonald's. And here's the fun fact, Kobe. That's exactly what fucking happened in Kuwait City.
Kuwait City. Oh, wow. That's how it's established.
Yeah, apologies to Naomi. This is not in the notes. I just remembered this during the break. So this is what lives in my mind sometimes. Kuwait City. So the largest consumer of Domino's pizza and McDonald's hamburgers in the world per capita, so per person per year, is Kuwait City. Kuwait City eats absolutely massive amounts of McDonald's and Domino's pizza. Why? Because you may remember that in 1991, there was a war in Kuwait. Iraq invaded Kuwait. The United States and Britain, let's not forget, invaded to push the Iraqis back into Iraq and to secure Kuwait. One of the features of the aircraft carriers that the U.S. deployed into the Gulf, the Persian Gulf, was that they had fast food restaurants on them. Because, don't ask why, it was a silly thing. It was like a Reagan era, like, what if we brought the comfort of McDonald's and Coca-Cola to our boys/girls, because we're going to call them children for some reason, abroad. And so they would, you know, feed people. They would feed people who didn't have homes, people who didn't have, got bombed out or got gassed out or got whatever, you know, were attacked during this invasion. And everyone was like, oh my God, these hamburgers.
Really?
These hamburgers are delicious. It was a completely new cuisine to the people of Wales.
Yeah, yeah.
They loved it.
It brought me to thinking about how big a thing it was when the first McDonald's, I don't know why I know this, came to Russia, and the queues were like extraordinary. Yeah. Something that's so mundane to some people is like everything to other people.
Yeah, but because it was new, and it's mundane to us because we've grown up with it. But if you had never seen a McDonald's hamburger and fries before, it would be something, it would be a completely different taste, texture, design concept than like any other foods that exist in the world. Mm. It was a unique foreign cuisine. So as Kuwait rebuilds in the 1990s, there's this huge demand for fast food because you can A, be in an air-conditioned building, and B, not have to cook your food. Someone just gives you food that's cheap, right?
Yeah.
Specifically, inexpensive. So when the airport was properly reconstructed in 1999, one of the first things that got built was, one, a McDonald's, but two, was rebuilding the infrastructural support in terms of like the delivery of goods rather than passengers. So the first thing that came in was like, we need the cargo planes to land.
Sure.
Then we can focus in on getting people to come to Kuwait City. So the Kuwait airport, which is the 11th busiest airport in the world today, was redesigned in 1999 to facilitate McDonald's and Domino's Pizza, which are the number one and number two restaurants in Kuwait. Wild. So this is the same thing. It turns out we tend to think, this is the seemingly unrelated wrap-up, if you will, we tend to consider these technological advances, right? That when if you build it, they will come, is the mentality that we have. And we tend to think of that as, if you build the train station, then people will come and they'll establish their businesses, and then whatever they bring with them will become part and parcel of that local community.
Yeah, yeah.
But actually what they're saying is, if you build it, they will come, is if you build an oyster shack, someone will build a railroad. If you build a McDonald's, someone will build an airport. There has to be, the thing that people want has to be there first. You cannot build a road and then expect things to come. You have to build a road to something. And for the people of the United States, that building the road to something in the 1840s to the 1890s was oyster restaurants. And today, for the people, 20 years ago, for the people of Kuwait City, it was McDonald's, because who doesn't love fast food?
Well, I don't like McDonald's, but yeah, generally.
There's some. Come on, Nando's.
Nando's, Domino's will do.
Yeah. So, Kobe, if you could, what did you learn today? What's some new fun information you have tucked away?
Well, this kind of ties in with something I don't know why I've been thinking about this recently. Again, this could be a YouTube deep dive or a conversation I'm going to have with ChatGPT after this. But the importance of your staple diet, because I've come from a migrant family. I was born in Nigeria, came to the UK. My mum makes largely the food that she grew up with before leaving here. And I was in a conversation with a high-end chef who's from a migrant family. And she's like saying, I make all this fancy food that a lot of my family won't ever taste because it's not the food that they grew up with. And at no point had I considered that oysters could be that staple diet that drove people to, like, this is what I grew up with. So I need to have oysters when I move. I need to upkeep my life, but I need that food that I am so wedded to, so ingrained in my life. And that's driven, and that desire for familiarity, for nostalgia, for your self-worth has driven the hubs that are the largest cities in the States. That's fascinating.
Yeah, it is a fun little thing. Yeah, it's the same thing as someone who is himself technically a migrant. Mm. There are many times where I think, I could really go for a blank. I think the
lake trout.
Lake trout. Yeah, lake trout. But I think two things that I cannot get. Now, one thing I cannot get actually in this country genuinely is a cheesesteak sub.
I can understand that being a desire. I can understand that.
It doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Like people are always like, oh, Mexican food. And like, yes, it is very, 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 very rare and difficult to get your hands on good, proper Mexican food in Britain. But that's why I make it myself. Mm. I import ingredients. I have friends from Mexico. I get stuff secreted to me. Like, you know, don't tell whoever. It's not enough to bother the officials. But that I can recreate. But I can't make a proper cheesesteak because I can't get the shredded steak that you're supposed to use. All I can get, and again, if I wasn't vegan, all I could get is steak, like just cuts of beef. You're like, that's not a cheesesteak, god damn it. And then the cheese whiz isn't right. And the rolls, actually the hardest part is getting a proper roll.
Yeah, I was thinking the roll might be the most difficult because we don't, in the outside of the States, we don't do bread like you guys do. Because we're like, what, really?
No, I want it to be soft, pillowy, and it should absorb as much liquid as possible. Yeah, I want some sugar in there. And if there's a color with a number attached to it, that's the correct way. So that's our lesson today. The world as you know it, turns out, may be built on the backs of oysters. You listener, thank you so much for listening to the show. You're listening to it right now on something. I don't know what it is. Is it Spotify? Is it Apple? It's a platform. There should be a button that says subscribe. The best thing you can do to help us out, if you liked this show, just hit that subscribe button. Because if you hit subscribe, not only will the new episodes pop up so that you can get the goods the second that it launches, but you can get the links to the show notes. You can get all sorts of lovely information from us, including maybe some bonus episodes down the road. So subscribing to the show in the app you're using right now, that's the number one way to help us. Number two way, if you want to give us some money right now, patreon.com/seemingly unrelated. You can get 10 bonus episodes today, this second, for just $2. You put $2 in, you can download 10 whole episodes immediately. So it's a really good deal. I think it's worthwhile. But most importantly, we would love for you to subscribe to the show. And Kobe, where can people find you on the internet? How can they keep up with the high quality entertainment that you provide?
So I'm, as far as I've tried deep dives, my name, Kobe Omanaka, is the only one I've found on the internet. So the easiest way to find me is to type in Kobe Omanaka and it will be me. Talking about pop culture, talking about marketing, talking about podcasting. Typically, that's one of the three things I talk about, yap about. Find me and think, okay, that seems like an interesting channel. Talking about a recent film or talking about The Wire. Subscribe to that. Yeah, do that.
Perfect. And Naomi, obviously, if you want to find her, you just come back to this podcast. So that's the number one way to get
you on the internet.
That's right. Naomi doesn't put any of that stuff out. So thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, Kobe. You've been an excellent guest co-host. And we will be back in 2 weeks to talk about something else we don't even know, but it's going to be fascinating. It's going to be factual. And it's going to be a lot of fun. So come back and we will see you then. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Seemingly Unrelated is a Life's Little Murder Boards production. Created and hosted by Andrew Johnstone, audio production and editing services provided by Naomi Coe. Our artwork is by Megan Zemet. The theme song is Irizumi by Pistol Jazz. To find out more about everyone involved and access the show notes for this episode, visit us at seeminglyunrelatedpod.com. We'll be right back.
when I was working in my first job post-university, when Wikipedia came out, I would print out the Wikipedia page, remove the images. And if you're working in an office, because you're walking around with paper, people think you were doing work. So I would go out and print out like the history of Spider-Man, remove all any images related to Spider-Man. I might just remove the main headline as well and print it out. And I'd just be sat there highlighting stuff. And people That's think I'd be actually amazing. Doing like proper work. And you're reading it intently and highlighting, going, okay, okay. So Uncle Ben, yeah, did he? Interesting.
Did he? Oh, no kidding.